Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello and welcome along to this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, the show that aims to get you thinking. Today on the show, something a bit different, a one-to-one interview between myself and Ugandan pastor Richmond Wandera. It's a show brought to you in partnership with Compassion this week. We'll also be hearing your feedback towards the end of today's show on the subject of demons and exorcism. Because that was our show title last week. A really interesting discussion. We'll hear your feedback to that. Plus, I'll be sharing a personal response as well to the Ravi Zacharias scandal. So look out for that towards the end of today's show. If you want more from the show, including an archive of programmes in the back catalogue, then do go to our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But right now, time for my interview with Richmond Wandera, Senior Pastor at New Life Baptist Church in Kampala, Uganda, and Director of the Pastors Discipleship Network in East Africa.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Now, Richmond has a unique perspective on life, faith and leadership because he was actually raised in a Ugandan slum, but today is the senior pastor of New Life Baptist Church in Kampala and the founder and director of Pastors Discipleship Network. It's a non-profit that serves, equips and trains thousands of pastors across East Africa. So I'm going to be talking to Richmond today about his story, about the theology that he's involved in, the church leadership, issues around Uganda, religion, Christianity and East Africa. And just looking forward to a really interesting conversation on the show today, and especially relevant actually for me, Richmond, because I had a gap year where I spent 6 months in Uganda. This is going back a long time now, but it's so lovely to meet you. And I understand you even have a connection with Unbelievable. You've been listening for a while to the show. Is that the case?
I have been an ardent fellow of Unbelievable. It's changed my life. It's changed the leaders in my network because we've been discussing a lot of what you all are discussing on the show. And so thank you so much, Justin, for bringing truth to our world and allowing us to engage. But another thing that you mentioned is you were in Uganda and you specifically spent time in Jinja.
Yes.
So now Jinja, I was born and raised there before moving to Kampala City. And so there is just a warm feeling about you being and loving my country and spending time where I am right now.
That's wonderful. It's great that we've got that connection. I have many friends still in Uganda and a new one in you, Richmond, which is wonderful. And I hope to come back at some point and visit again. It's been a long time since my wife and I were in Uganda. Tell me a little bit about, first of all, your role there as a church leader in Uganda. Tell me about New Life Baptist Church and the kind of community that you're serving in Kampala.
New Life Baptist Church is set in Chireka community, and it's the kind of community that was regarded by many as a forgotten community. If you put a pin at New Life Baptist Church and put a circle 1.5 mile radius around the church, Justin, you'd have circled over 200 brothels.
Wow.
We're right in the heart of it. We are a highly Muslim community with a lot of children who are not in school. Poverty has hit this community like no other in the country. And when we were thinking of a place to plant the church, one of the words that guided us was the darkest place. And so we ended up planting a church in Chireka. And so I'm really honored to see all the transformation that the church has led and championed in this community, not just in terms of people coming to Christ and finding truth and hope in the gospel, but the change that's happening in the community as a result of the other things that we do under the theme of justice for the community. So that's really a summary of where we are. We're right in the heart of darkness in Uganda. My heart for Pastors Discipleship Network, though, is a heart for equipping leaders. I have a PhD in philosophy of leadership, and in Africa, leadership is one of the biggest gaps, and it's led to a lot of pain and suffering and a lot of disorder. And my hope is to bring the leadership skills and knowledge and everything that I have got from my time paying attention to research and reading and critiquing, and then bringing that to those who are working with me to make a difference in Uganda. But a big heart of mine is in the theology side. Obviously, I'm very driven by what Christ said, that the blind man cannot lead a blind man, because if that happens, they will both fall in a ditch. And my heart and love for my people in Uganda wants to protect them from this ditch.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Uganda itself before we come to speaking of particularly some of the social, cultural, theological sort of issues that exist there. Now, when I was there 20 plus years ago now, President Museveni was in power. I understand he is still in power today. And obviously, there have been issues just recently around elections. It's been in our newsfeed as well that there's been some unrest in Uganda recently. Do you want to just update us on what the situation is at present out there, Richmond?
It's a very tough time we're living in right now. We just had the presidential elections about a week ago. And in order to shield Uganda from scrutiny in the West, our internet was shut down. Social media was shut down. News couldn't leave this country to go out. And so that's the first phase of change, unprecedented change like we have never seen. And then beyond that, after the pronouncing of the current president as president again since 1986, we have seen a lot of chaos that ensued following that. Now, obviously, there's been a strong presence of the military and the police in the streets to try to curtail any other response. But it's been a tough, tough season. Anyone in business is struggling, especially business that has to do with online. Anyone who is pursuing work or tasks at any company that bases on email or the internet is basically crashing. It's a very hard time, yeah.
And I imagine this comes obviously in the wake of COVID, which has impacted Uganda just as much as any other country. What has been the effect of the COVID pandemic there?
Well, Uganda has been hit probably the most in the whole of East and Central Africa. I think about the first statistic that that our economists have just put up. There's a very clear statement that it's going to take another 15 years for the Uganda's economy to recover to the point that it was before COVID. And even then, that point was not good. The unemployment rate as a result of companies shutting down is unbelievable. The people that have gone through hunger and pushed beyond hunger into starvation and some death has been a number that's unbelievable. Part of the thing that I was championing during this COVID was providing food for the poorest of the poor. And I joined ministries like Compassion and others to make sure that we don't lose that many people during this COVID time. So when you think about the poor and those that have been affected, the category that comes out the most is the children, obviously. As they were locked down under the lockdown that the entire country experienced, and many of them stayed home in houses where there was no food, there was no provision, there was no work. And so the children were affected the most. And then the mothers, especially the single mothers who had no other partner to bring in any support. And so it's been a very, very tough year, and it continues to be tough for us in the country.
I mean, you mentioned Compassion there, and I should say that today's show is very much being brought in partnership with Compassion, and I'll talk a little bit more about that and the amazing work and your own story and how it connects with Compassion as a child sponsor. But I mean, I the COVID situation has, you know, in a sense, affects different parts of the world very differently, given the different economic situations that exist. And I've got friends in Uganda who've been hit super hard by COVID. So I'm aware of just the huge hardship that involves. But I do want to spend a little time talking about, you know, the history a little bit of Christianity in Uganda and East Africa. I mean, many people, are unaware of the way in which Christianity, especially a kind of Pentecostal form maybe of Christianity, really swept East Africa in the latter part of the 20th century. I mean, they call it the East African Revival. Huge numbers of people becoming Christians, but probably in the West, probably we're not actually that familiar with the way Christianity has just exploded really across the African continent in those kinds of ways. Do you want to just give us a sense of kind of what that's looked like in the recent decades in Uganda specifically, but across the East African continent?
Yes. So Uganda was colonized by Britain, and only in 1962 did we as a nation receive our independence. And during this period of colonization, it followed naturally that religion was part of the narrative. And so a lot of people in Uganda became Christians and began to learn about this new religion called Christianity. And so in 1962, when Uganda got its independence, even the king himself associated with Christianity. And that continued to 1971, when Idi Amin became president. Now, Idi Amin was a Muslim, and he had one main agenda: to turn Uganda into a Muslim nation. And so their persecution began, and so many people lost their lives. Many Christians fled. I know personally pastors who fled in 1973 and left the country fleeing for their lives. We had very grotesque cases of people being forced to eat whatever they were wearing on their feet if they were found preaching the gospel. The kind of gruesome persecution that led to a lot of people fleeing. But in 1979, when Idi Amin was overthrown or fled the country, we began to see a freedom return to the church. And in that wake is when people began to pray and to repent and to come before God saying, "Heal our land." And it was in the midst of prayer that many people began to seek Christianity, or at least the consideration of Christianity, as a priority. They had tested another religion, and they have tested what that could do. And so now they were looking for an alternative. And so people began to run towards Christianity to understand it for themselves. You know, for the most part, the literature around Uganda will communicate Christianity as a religion that someone was born in. And so without necessarily engaging personally and understanding God for themselves, they associated with Christianity. They would call themselves Christians without knowing what Christianity really is. And so at this point, though, people began to seek God for themselves. In fact, in my morning devotion yesterday, I was reading Job's words when he said, "My ears had heard about you, but now my eyes have seen you." The idea that I knew only about you, I had the knowledge of you from someone else, but now it's a personal religion. And I think that's what gave birth to the East African Revival. People began to pursue God for themselves. And so what really happened was that from this wake, Rwanda, Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, and Burundi began to awaken to a personal experience or a personal journey with God, which was quote unquote, called Christianity. And so that continued up until the late 80s, where there was a war that was coming in. The current president was coming in 1986. And already what the waves that had been started by this revival, so to speak, began to be curtailed by some of the war that was going on, which is probably the worst of the wars our nation has seen. And it's normally dubbed the Luwero Triangle War, where two rebel groups were pressing against the government at the same time. And that, along with many other things, began to slow down the fire, so to speak, of this revival. But then these many Christians that had received God and had a personal experience with God began to raise a generation of people that would call on the name of the Lord, those who would subscribe to Christianity. And remember that in the background, there's a lot of wars that are going on. And so a lot of fathers were falling. In fact, my dad was killed within this same period. And so a lot of people became fatherless and homeless. So many orphans began to emerge. And about this time, many people still associated with the Christian faith, but then they didn't have people to teach them how to live, to teach them the Christian walk. And so the Christianity kept on spreading. And so about 15 years, for the first time, we began to see an awakening of the need to train pastors. People began to recognize the place of training, the place of theology, the place of understanding, the place of grasping meaning, and asking tough questions about the Christian faith for themselves, such that the new generation of Christians can be grounded. And so we are, I think, still living in that time when there's a generation, which I would say like my generation, that grew up without fathers, or a fatherless generation, that at the back of our minds associated to the Christian faith, but yet now there was questions that forced new dialogue that had to be answered. And I think that we are at a very good place, Justin. In 1971, between 1971 and 1979, the number of Christianity, or the percentage of Christians, came down to as low as 15% of the entire nation's population. Well, right now, if you put denominations together, and without kind of cutting those denomination lines, Uganda is 84% a Christian nation.
Wow.
There's been an awakening. There's been an opportunity that has been given to this generation like never before. And so we are seeing a need and a hunger of this new generation to understand for themselves what it means to be Christian. But the environment is very enabling for the Christian church.
Yeah, that's so interesting to hear the background to it and the history that's brought you to this place. I mean, obviously, even when Christianity becomes very widespread, it doesn't mean that all the social ills of a country disappear overnight. And of course, one of the issues I noticed when I was in Uganda, you know, as I say, going back 20 years now, and I don't know how different the situation may be today, but was that there was a pressing need for theological education, that the church was growing fast. But when the church grows fast, very often the theological underpinnings don't grow with it. And when I went out into, you know, more rural areas, especially, I would find a lot of a kind of blend, really, I suppose, of folk religion, maybe former kind of things that were more associated with witchcraft and curses and things being kind of put together with Orthodox Christianity. How much is that an issue now, would you say? What kind of is needed in Uganda to kind of help the Christian church grow in a good direction?
Justin, that continues to be a problem. The blend of African folk religion and African traditional religion with Christianity continues to be a massive problem. I'll give you two examples. The first one is how fast or how quickly pastors are changing their names to mirror almost witchcraft. So a little bit of a background here. In Uganda, most witch doctors will not use their given names for their practice or for their job. They would use more scary names. For example, the man who sits on a lion, or the man who would swallow pins without being hurt, or the man who sends back curses. And so those would be the names, Mbizayo, Ntulakungo. Those are very scary names. And so it kind of tells the people that if you have a problem, maybe it's a woman who's struggling to have children, or there's a person who has a problem with their neighbor, you go to such a person. And if there's been witchcraft done against you, or a curse, that person will send it back and set you free. Well, think about that kind of thinking and then see what's happening in the church today. Most pastors, I mean, next to us is a pastor who's changed his name to Mbizayo. I send whatever is against you back to where it came from. So if it's witchcraft, come to me and the witchcraft is back. And so on Mbizayo, there is another pastor who calls himself the one who gives prosperity. And there's a coined word, a local word for that. And you wouldn't even know his given name or his surname. You wouldn't even know that. But that's just infiltrating the church. And pastors cannot divorce themselves from this African folk religion. And that's what I seek to try to explain, that this blend that is coming in seems to be in some cases branded as African versions of Christianity, but it surely has some taints that are very dangerous for the new believers who are trying to understand.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many questions I want to ask at this point. I suppose one thing that is immediately apparent, if you like, is that the kind of environment that you are doing your Christian witnessing and theology and everything is quite different to the average Western environment, where it's a very secular outlook here. You know, the idea of curses and demons and witchcraft, it all sounds like something in a Harry Potter novel, not something we encounter in real life. But in Uganda, there is a more of a kind of, in that sense, supernaturalism dimension to people's everyday kind of thinking and reality, right? So in that sense, would you say the kind of issues that you're having to speak into and deal with are in a sense more directly issues around, you know, the way people engage the supernatural and that kind of thing, not so much trying to persuade people to believe in God in the first place? It's kind of bringing people to a correct understanding of God rather than a kind of, you know, some issue of, you know, I just need to appease the demons or make sure the spirits are kind of serving me or whatever it is.
Yeah, I would say that, Justin, that actually many people in Uganda would laugh at the West because the Western narrative that has been communicated to the people in Uganda is that Satan doesn't exist, God doesn't exist, demons are not at work, there are no blessings, there are no curses, that doesn't exist. Well, in Uganda, that is, it's almost part of our culture, part of the way we live. Typically, if a person will succeed in business, no one will say that person succeeds in business because they work hard. No, the reason that would be attributed to that would be when this person was a child, the mother washed this child with the right herbs, spoke the right words over this child. And lo and behold, see what the child has become. And so then there is the side of science. For the most part, the West is very science-driven, very evidence-based. While in Uganda, people's life experience has been shown to portray almost a different life experience from the West. Now, it's a mystery. I don't know that anybody could say they fully understand it. But Justin, I'm speaking to you right now, and I have seen things, okay? I have a master's degree. I have a PhD in philosophy of leadership. I have read a lot of books that would argue that there is no such thing as spirituality. Well, I have seen things which there is not a laboratory or something that could explain what I have seen. And so it's first of all misleading if someone says that the people that believe in witchcraft, the people that believe in blessings and curses are not educated. No, I would say that many of the people who are actually engaged in a lot of this practice are educated. They've been exposed to science, they've been exposed to labs, but they have a life experience that cannot be denied. And so what my role and what many of the past roles I see is that, is can we drive a wedge between this blend of folk religion and African traditionalism and Christianity, because that is dangerous. And how do we sort through that carefully without throwing out the baby with the bathwater? How can we do that? It's a difficult and very challenging task.
Yeah. And in a sense, I could imagine there are equally those who say, but Richmond, you shouldn't, you know, just embrace this Western view of Christianity and lose the kind of your African background. You know, there is even, you know, I've spoken to black Christians here in the UK who are kind of thrown over Christianity because they say we were given a kind of white man's version of Christianity, which divorced it from my African roots. And they're going back to something that's maybe like a black Israel, Hebrew, Israelite kind of view or the kind of black consciousness movement and saying we need to re-embrace kind of the folk religion that kind of, you know, that is of my ancestors rather than this kind of thing that got imported, you know, colonially as Christianity. So how do you navigate that balance? Because you don't want to just be another, you know, kind of version of a kind of Western white Christian, but also there's evidently Christ has made a huge difference to the way you now understand God, spirituality, and the spiritual atmosphere you find yourself in Uganda, Richmond.
Absolutely, Justin. There were some errors made by the early missionaries. And sadly, we are still paying the price for some of those errors that were made. When the early missionaries came, their statement was clear to those who would follow Christianity that your drums are evil, your music instruments are evil. When you come in here, you use these hymn books, you stand in this way, forget rhythm, forget dancing, forget praise, forget those celebrations. When you come, this is exactly how you do it. Let the whole earth be silent, for God is in his holy temple. There is this idea that came in with the early missionaries. And anyone who followed the missionaries, for whatever reason, whether it's the benefits that came by closely associating with missionaries or genuine believers who took on this faith, there was this new adaptation to Western practice. And the drums were kicked out of the church. The instruments and our style and our rhythm and our dance was all kicked out of the church. Well, until the last 30 years, that has always been the flaw. But there's been questioning, some rigorous questioning that has been going on over the last 30 years. People are saying, what of what was introduced to us was true biblical Christianity and what was simply Western practice or Western portrayal of Christianity? And that is the conversation that has led to where we are right now, where people are saying that, is the African drum truly evil? What makes something evil? Can an instrument in itself be evil? And all these things began to be the conversation that people began to engage with. And then that's when the list of mistakes that were made by previous missionaries that were good people, but they made these mistakes innocently. And so we began to see that there is a list that's developing on what mistakes we made. And then the list of that way, of that which we must do now to correct those kinds of mistakes. Now, obviously, as any discussion, as any dialogue would go, some people will swing all the way to the right and some all the way to the left. And there is an error. But for me, I think striking a middle balance and being objective about this and not just reacting to colonial rule, yeah, and colonial introductions to colonial practice, rather than just reacting mindlessly, I think it's really important to strike.
Yeah. I liked the way one former hippie put it, who was kind of converted in the kind of Jesus People revolution, in America. And he said, you know, some people said I wasn't able to do my rock music anymore because I'd become a Christian. And he said, but when I got baptized, my guitar got baptized with me. So maybe it's a similar situation. You know, God obviously does use everyone's ethnic background and cultural background, but it becomes redeemed. It becomes, you know, used in his service ultimately. But just to stick with this issue, I suppose, of the way obviously the West has been, you know, originally in colonial terms impacted the way people then took on Christianity. Even today, I think that there are some people who see a negative influence, particularly from the prosperity gospel movement, maybe that has developed, especially in parts of the US, and which have been embraced almost wholesale and maybe even gone even further in parts of Africa. I mean, do you encounter that a lot in Uganda, and how do you respond to it yourself?
I'll say to you that some of the most dangerous or most lethal messages that have come from the West to the African space has been the prosperity gospel or the health and wealth movement or the name it and claim it movement, which started in the late 70s and maybe even in the 80s. And televangelists took this on and began to drum this. I think for the most part, Africa was still trying to wrestle with the question, what is African Christianity? And does that really exist? And we're trying to formulate an African Christian experience and to clearly understand it. But in the midst of all of this is when we got this messaging that came through very strongly through our televisions. I can say to you that when I first started watching Christian television, which was in my late teenage years, finally access to a TV, I can say that majority of the hours on our Christian television was by very wealthy American televangelists that were broadcasting a single message. For example, some of the messages I clearly remember to this day is, hey, there's this one handkerchief. If you buy it, your problems are sorted. I just had a word from God. And if you also sell $7 or $77 or $777 or $7,000, you would receive in the next 7 days, seven times over the thing you are. I mean, that's messaging to this very, I could just recite it because that's exactly what we are. And people, I mean, the poorest of the poor got their $7, put that in the mail and sent it to these ministries. And that just crushed us because at the end of the day, when someone has heard from God through the man of God and sowed in faith, and time after time, it's turning out different from what the evangelist promised it would be. Man, it crushes faith. It crushes understanding and conviction in Christianity as a true religion. And so it gives birth to what we are experiencing right now, which is a people who would say they are Christians, but they're not really Christians. And so we are wrestling with that right now because, Justin, here's the thing. The prosperity gospel is attractive. It's so attractive. It's dangerously attractive. It's the kind that I would categorize as that which people's itching ears want to hear. When you think about a person in poverty, what message do you think a person in deep poverty is eager and longing to hear? And it's a message of hope no matter what is contained in it. Even if it's false hope and it takes them through a day or two, that they sometimes they become happy with that. And then they begin to realize that what's making me happy and soothing my difficult situation may not necessarily be true because over the last period of times I have tested it, it's proved false, but it's appealing and it's good. And guess what? When that became available in our environment, and most pastors, even the true pastors, began to realize that that's what people wanted to hear. And they abandoned truth and took on this prosperity gospel. And it swept through. If you look at the numbers, the rate at which the prosperity gospel is growing and increasing is heartbreaking. You wouldn't believe. It's faster than wildfire. And to even try to curtail it. Now, just in some of what I'm doing is helping pastors return to truth. But some of the biggest criticism I have received, some of the biggest attacks I have received has been from the people that have made it, the pastors that have made it through this prosperity gospel. And they're saying, you're cutting off our water supply. And so, Justin, we find ourselves in a very hard place. And yeah. But we're fighting.
Yeah. I would say the question then is, how do you respond to poverty? Because as you said, the reason the prosperity gospel is so attractive is because it offers an easy answer. You know, if you just do this, say this prayer, give this amount of money, then, you know, all your problems go away. And obviously that is not the gospel. But it's very easy for me as a Western person in a very comfortable situation to say, isn't it terrible? But the reality is poverty will, you know, is crippling. And you can fully understand why that message becomes so attractive in a particular environment. How do you then, in your church, Richmond, and obviously through the Pastors Discipleship Network across East Africa, how do you respond in a biblical way to poverty? And what are you seeing happen?
You know, I'll just share what recently happened during this COVID time. Some things are happening in Africa, Justin, that I think the world would do well to pay attention to and even possibly learn from. People are more generous than we think. People have potential for good, sacrificial kind of good that would blow your mind away. During this COVID period, we mobilized the church and talked about how the church is to respond in times of crisis and in times of suffering. And we saw two things happen. People who had very little to live on were able to share the little they had with the church so that the church could bring that food to communities and to people that needed it the most. I mean, the poor person giving from the little they have to someone else who is in great need. And Justin, you were here about 20 years ago. You might have experienced something like this. And most people who are connected to children in Africa, maybe as their sponsors or by someone else, would see this a lot, that when they visit, this poor family would get their only chicken and give it to this person to say thank you. And oftentimes I've seen people rejecting and saying, hey, that's all you have. I need to be giving you another chicken. That people say, no, I'll share with you the little that I have. And so what I saw, Justin, was just humbling and inspiring to see how the poor were able to pull together resources and help fellow poor people. The second thing I saw, Justin, is something that I started with New Life Baptist Church, but other churches caught onto it very fast. And we called it temporary adoption. And temporary adoption was simply an offer by families within the church who could feed one child, one extra child. Offering to families who knew if the children stayed in their homes, they would die. And these children, essentially, for as long as these other families could keep them, exchanging and giving these children on to these families. And obviously, we were supervising them and making sure that it was done properly. But it was amazing to see the people. I mean, I'll share Pastor Peter, who is my pastor, growing up as a child in a child development program. Pastor Peter, he has four children of his own. He's already adopted three children, received three additional children. Remember, he was at a point where financially things are not good at all, but he couldn't stand on the sidelines and see a child dry out, stand alone in the cold and hungry. And so we began to see the church give so generously in ways that's amazing. And it's almost a writing on the wall to anyone who is very individualistic, someone who feels, I have to take care of me first, my insurance, my this, my that, and then I'll take care of someone else. It's almost a writing on the wall for that person to read and say, look, life is more meaningful and it's more beautiful when we live not just for ourselves, but we see other people as well. So that's the first thing that I have seen in which poverty, in a way, poverty is addressed by awakening the church to the power of love, the power of practical love and active giving. The second thing I have seen is how parachurch organizations or ministries that work through the local church are able to reach out to people who are generous, who are not necessarily in communities that are struggling the way other communities are, and saying to them, look, you can support financially, and through the local church, we can make this help available. And I think that's what we have seen. Obviously, that's my experience. It was a parachurch organization that's whose mission was to train to release children from poverty in Jesus' name, that connected me to a 15-year-old girl who committed to sponsor me through my years of suffering. And I am here today. And I think that that kind of working through the local church, caused the local church to shine, was, I think, another very effective way of releasing people from poverty. I mean, look at me. I've been totally released from poverty at every sense of the word. And that has been through God's work, through parachurch organizations that partner with the local church that is in these broken communities to make a difference. And so awakening the local people to look at what is in their hands and how can they use that. And then to go on from there to say, how can the universal church participate in attacking this monster called poverty?
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to come in a moment to talking about specifically Compassion, who is the parachurch organization you're referencing there, and the way that they have helped to lift so many communities out of poverty by this extraordinary child sponsorship program that they run. But before we get to that, just tell me a little bit of that background of yourself. I mean, what was the conditions that you grew up in yourself, Richmond? And just tell me that story of what happened when you received this extraordinary sponsorship and what that difference that made, I suppose, in terms of where you are now.
Yeah. So, Justin, when I was 8, what I feared the most happened to me. My father was killed, and that just shattered our home. I was the third born of 6 children, and my mother was uneducated. We ended up leaving our home and landing in Uganda's worst slum at the time, called Naguru. By the time I was 9 years old, I had dropped out of school. My mother was bedridden because of sickness, and I was on the street. By the time I was 10 years old, I had already suffered from malaria 10 times, coming to near-death situations. But everything changed when Compassion International intervened and connected me to a 15-year-old girl called Heather, who sponsored me. And her sponsorship did so much. I was able to go back to school. I was able to find food daily. I was able to be treated whenever I felt sick, and literally brought into a community and into a space where local African God-fearing people who feel called to serve children were present for us, and they protected me. And that's where a lot of healing happened in my life. By the time I was 14, I made a decision to follow Christ. By the time I was 17, I had seen all 4 of my siblings, except 2, make a decision to follow Christ. Justin, when I was 19, I witnessed my mother make a decision to follow Christ. At the age of 22, I was invited to become the associate pastor at the very church that I was plugged in as a Compassion child. Today, I have the absolute honor of being the senior pastor of this church, and I'm just so honored to be given this.
It's an amazing story, and what I love about this is that, I mean, obviously, every time anyone sponsors a child, they're sponsoring the future of that child, really, and that future will impact so many more people. So in your case, it's been about church ministry, leadership, that's community leadership as well. But also, you know, receiving an amazing theological education. I mean, you as you say, you have a degree, a PhD. And that is something I think people often forget is that also makes a huge difference, because the church needs educated leaders. It needs people who understand theology, who are able to make a real difference in these places where Christianity is growing so quickly, as we said, but also needs direction and needs that, you know, firm kind of leadership and good theology behind it as well, doesn't it?
First, I agree 100%, because My mind fixes on the word potential. Justin, if you met me as an 8-year-old on the street, the way I was dressed, the way I looked, what I was eating, how I was, you would never see a leader. You'd never see an accountant. You'd never see a pastor. It leads me to conclude that potential is everywhere, but opportunity isn't. So the more people can choose to live simply so that others can simply live, to live with less so that others can live with more, choosing a life, I mean, it's a voluntary choice. Like, look, I will enter this space and release this child's potential. The more that can happen, the more we begin to see what's happening right now. The first thing is the ripple effects. So as a child who's grown out of poverty and now released from poverty, I am pastoring and teaching my community truth. But Justin, before I became a pastor, I was an accountant. I taught accounting at Uganda Christian University and in Makerere University Business School. I taught accounting, and for 5 years, my mission was one, to heal my corrupt country by developing ethical accountants. And for 5 years, I drummed that drum loud. And so many young accountants and who are now very, very experienced professional accountants are in good positions that are making a difference where they are. And so it's potential, but it's also a decision people have to make. To choose to live with less, to live simply. And I think people don't realize the power of one act, one decision, and how that can literally change the world. And so, again, the other thing I'd say looking back is that 20 years ago, this child who was helped, Heather did not think of me as an inheritance for my nation. So what Heather has done, voluntarily or involuntarily, knowing or unknowing, is she's given Uganda, my nation, an inheritance of a fully formed leader, one who fears the Lord, one who will work ethically, and who will spend their life making a difference. That's an inheritance that Heather has given to our nation, and I'm working as hard as possible to generate the next group of emerging leaders and handing them forward as an inheritance. I think about the millions of people who are touched by Heather's single decision and how those now form an inheritance to the nation of Uganda, and how powerful one act is when someone has the courage to put their foot down and say, look, you know what, Skip, I'm just going to go in and I'm going to fight. I'm going to join this fight.
Richmond, it's been so good to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with me on the program today. Your story is so powerful, and you've obviously said how different your life would be if you hadn't had a compassion sponsor. Now, if you're listening to the podcast or watching the video right now, we're doing something kind of unique in today's episode. We've decided to partner with Compassion International to find more sponsors for children who were very much like Richmond in the same situation. And we've got this partnership with Compassion for today's episode because we trust the way they work. When you invest in the life of a child every month, you can be sure that 80% of that is being spent specifically for the development of that little boy or girl that you sponsor. Compassion doesn't give money directly to children because they know that just handing out money isn't going to make a long-term impact. But spending that money wisely for nutrition and healthcare and education, teaching boys and girls to grow up and escape poverty, well, that does make a huge difference. And as we've heard from Richmond, Compassion does it all through local churches around the world. So we've got a bit of a goal today on today's episode of finding new sponsors. We'd love to sponsor at least 100 children with today's episode in 2021. That would be amazing, wouldn't it? It's like kind of like sponsoring a large village almost of children. And we'll make it really simple for you. You've got two options, okay? The first is that right now, even as you're listening or watching, you can literally open up a text on your phone and send my name, Justin, to 83393. That's Justin to 83393. Now, that'll only work if you live in the US, I should say. And if you do that, you're going to get a text back with a picture of a child and a link. You just click that link, follow the steps to start sponsoring. It's really, really easy. So again, that's a text to 83393 and just send my name, Justin, on it. Okay. Now, the second option is also very easy, and it's going to work from the US or anywhere in the world. So if you go to compassion.com /Justin. Okay. Again, compassion.com/Justin. You can choose exactly which boy or girl you want to sponsor. So we're trying to make this really easy for you. We've worked with Compassion. So you'll also get a free gift, actually, if you're in the US when you start sponsoring. That's the unbelievable book. That's my story of the show and my faith. And why I'm still a Christian after 10 years of talking with atheists. That's only, unfortunately, just for logistics, available in the US if you can sponsor. But we will send you a copy of Unbelievable as a thank you. And if you've already got a copy of the book, maybe it'll make a great gift for someone else. And again, as Richmond has said, one of the reasons we've decided this is so important right now is because of that COVID-19 situation, which we know is having a devastating effect all over the world. But we know how much it's radically changed our lives in the UK, the US, but countries like Uganda, where many people live in deep poverty, we're seeing thousands more children being forced to the point of starvation. Families can't work. I have friends in Uganda, and I have seen and heard, and they've sent me videos of what's happening. So anything you can do makes a huge difference, because jobs are on the line, schools are closed. The World Health Organization saying COVID is setting international poverty development efforts back at least 10 years. So we feel strongly about this. So if you're able to make a difference, again, we would love to see as many children sponsored as possible through Compassion. Again, in the US, you can text 83393 and make sure to put Justin on the text. And you'll get a link to follow and start sponsoring. And you'll also be sent a free copy of the book as well. Or from the US or anywhere else, you can go to the website, compassion.com/Justin, and choose a boy or girl to sponsor from, as many as 25 different countries. But it's been so good to catch up with you, Richmond. One question I've got just before we close out is, in a sense, hearing how different our contexts are. The reality is that most of the time, my Unbelievable show, we're often speaking into a Western context where there is a kind of, obviously, that the secular Christian divide is perhaps much greater than it has been in Uganda and East Africa. So why have you been a listener in Uganda? And you even told me before we started recording that you spent a whole month discussing the Jordan Peterson and Susan Blackmore edition of our big conversation. So what's that all about? Tell me why, you know, you've found this a helpful resource even in your different situation.
First of all, thank you, Justin, for the Unbelievable show. It's a podcast. It's just literally changing our lives, and this is why. Uganda for a long time has been branded, as many African countries have been, as a part of the dark continent, where there's folk religion, tradition, witchcraft, and almost like backward thinking. Well, that's changing, and changing quickly. We are experiencing an invasion of secularism, postmodern thought, and many of these other schools of thought that previously we are not even on the surface, not even on the radar, for us to engage with. Now, when the younger generation is beginning to ask questions, two fears are hitting our minds, and especially the minds of pastors. One, we are not educated, generally speaking, as pastors. The average pastor would have finished what we'd call senior three, so the kind of class that you'd be in if you were 14 or 15 years old. And so most pastors would have dropped out of school at that level. The current generation has now moved light years ahead of that. And so the level of education of the average population has gone up significantly beyond where most pastors would be. So that's already creating this fear in pastors of irrelevance. And then that's the first thing. The second thing is the fact that many pastors, live alone mainline education, are not theologically trained. Even those that might have their first degree don't have theological training. And yet the questions that this emerging generation as asking are questions they're drawing from the internet, very difficult, complex, apologetic type questions. And the pastors are using all kinds of tactics, saying, hey, don't go to the internet. That you're hanging out with the wrong friends. Who taught you to ask those questions? And they're trying to be tough. But within the pastors, there's a fear that's kind of sweeping over the land. And so we said, look, rather than hiding and shying away from these tough conversations, let's engage them. Because what else are we going to do? And so that's when I began on a journey of trying to find out who is actually engaging these talks in a balanced way. And I landed on Unbelievable. And so your discussions, especially I mean, I can mention many here, but the one I mentioned to you earlier on, Jordan Peterson, Sudan Blackmore, we were able to draw that out and kind of peel back the curtain and see what's going on in the minds of these two individuals. And then how does this separate itself from our current position? I could go in detail on how we went around it, but I can say to you that month brought a lot of clarity and a lot of help to many of these very untrained pastors that are hungry and thirsty for training, hence what I do with Pastors Discipleship Network.
Well, it's just such a joy to know that the show is reaching and making a difference. It was the last thing I expected, if I'm honest. But I hope to be able to return myself to Uganda, where there's still a piece of my heart in Uganda. And so I would love to return and spend time there with friends, make new friends as well. And maybe even, hey, have some conversations for the show out there as well. But it's been so good. Thank you very much for joining me on the show today, Richmond.
Thank you.
Well, wouldn't it be amazing if we could see 100 Children for Compassion sponsored through Unbelievable and see more stories like Richmond's come to life? If you would like to get involved, if you're in the US, you can text 83393. Just text the word Justin to that number. So that's text Justin to 83393. Or you can go online at compassion.com/Justin. And as a thank you to anyone who's able to sponsor from the US, you will receive a copy of my book, Unbelievable: Why, After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. Again, that's compassion.com/Justin. And that web link will work wherever you are in the world, so you don't have to be in the US to use that. We can only send books, I'm afraid, to those who are sponsoring from the US. But if you'd like to sponsor a child from anywhere in the world, you're more than welcome to use that link as well and join in the effort to see 100 children sponsored for Compassion. Wouldn't that be an amazing target to reach? Time to go to a quick break, and we'll be back with my personal response to the Ravi Zacharias scandal and your feedback to recent editions of the show.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of the show. Your feedback coming up soon on demons and exorcism, as we look at some of your feedback to recent editions of the show. Later on tonight at 8 p.m. here on Premier, Andy Peck talks to Chick Yule about his life and faith as a leader in the Salvation Army. And Chick has recently joined our roster of radio presenters as well. That's also available on its own profile podcast. And I'm going to tell you shortly what's coming up next week on the programme too. Just something, though, that you might want to put in your diary for this coming week. I've been mentioning this the last couple of weeks on the show. Questions of Our Times is a special set of lectures on Zoom, completely free, that you can attend from this coming Tuesday, the 23rd of February. It's put on by the Christian Evidence Society. I'm a trustee, and they're a great organisation helping to make the case for Christianity in various ways. And the Tuesday evening seminars begin this Tuesday with former Cabinet Minister Jonathan Aitken discussing the question, in a world of fake news, who can we trust? And the series concludes on the 23rd of March. There's about five of these, with former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, addressing prayer and spirituality. It'll all be hosted by Nigel Bovey, who's vice chair of the Christian Evidence Society and former editor of the Salvation Army magazine, The War Cry. If you'd like to register for this free Zoom event, go to christianevidence.org. That's christianevidence.org. Now, on next week's show, we're going to be bringing you a special response to the Ravi Zacharias scandal, with guests joining myself and Ruth Jackson, asking why this happened, how we can see things from the victim's perspective, and what lessons can be learned. As I say, guests to be confirmed for that for next week. But the independent report that was published about a week and a half ago has certainly rocked the world of Christian ministry and apologetics, as it detailed the damning findings of Ravi's double life, the sexual abuse and emotional and spiritual abuse that happened at his hands. So I wanted to put out a response of my own to this. And the way I'd begin it is this way. I didn't want it to be true, but it was true. And now a global ministry has been shipwrecked and the legacy of one of the most influential Christian apologists has been just swept away. And I felt so sad for those close to Ravi whose trust was abused, for the many who believed because of his ministry and have now been left devastated, and most especially the victims who have suffered horrible spiritual, emotional and sexual abuse. And in the case of Lori-Ann Thompson, public defamation at the hands of Ravi and the ministry. The heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? Says Jeremiah 17, verse 9. And that verse has been in my head recently, not just because of how it speaks to Ravi's own deceptive heart, but because of the ways that we're all willing to be deceived in one way or another. There's been a flood of responses since the independent report was published, laying bare the scale of Ravi's deceit. They debated how it happened, why it happened, whether Azim can or should recover from this, whether Ravi's book should be withdrawn and so on. And this isn't really a response about any of that precisely. It's more of a personal response, a mea culpa of sorts. Ravi was one of the preeminent Christian apologists in the world, and although I personally never met him or interviewed him for my Unbelievable show, his fall touches very closely to home because I have worked closely with the wider team of Azim. And shortly after his death in May 2020, I hosted a tribute show to Ravi, interviewing key leaders from Azim. The warm words and anecdotes that were shared then have just turned to ashes in all our mouths, as have those that were shared by the celebrities and church leaders at his funeral service, which was live streamed to millions. We've now taken the step of taking down our own YouTube edition of that show we recorded, and I've added a disclaimer in our podcast archive that show clearly no longer represents a true picture of Ravi. At the time we recorded it, the Spa allegations were unknown, of course. But nevertheless, like so many others, I was too quick to give Ravi the benefit of the doubt over those sexting allegations from 2 years previous. I didn't ask the awkward questions I should have asked because, well, as I said, I didn't want it to be true. I wanted Ravi to be the hero of the hour, to have a great legacy for the work of Azim to continue strong. I was wrong, as were many of us who too willingly accepted the narrative that he and the organisation put out around the Lori-Ann Thompson affair. It was only when the new credible Spa allegations came to light in September and the independent report eventually released its full damning conclusions about Ravi's predatory and abusive behaviour that we all realised just how wrong we were. None of us saw what was coming, but I should have been more sceptical to start with. For that reason, I do want to publicly apologise to people like Steve Borman of Ravi Watch and fellow apologist Randall Rouser, whose voices, frankly, I chose to tune out when they were in my timeline asking inconvenient questions about Ravi at the time of his death, while the rest of the world was heaping on adulation. I had wanted to believe in Ravi, the master apologist, the family man, the spiritual hero, but our heroes always have a habit of letting us down, don't they? And now with the truth laid bare, and perhaps only even a portion of that, I'm left with the question, how can we do better than this? Ultimately, the person responsible for what happened was Ravi Zacharias, and he'll answer to God for the sins against his victims that he took with him to the grave. But the rest of us need to ask ourselves hard questions about the kind of culture that allowed Ravi's deception to occur, and to make sure it can't happen again. So here are five suggestions. One. We need to be more sceptical. We need to question our heroes. I run a show that involves asking and responding to hard questions from sceptics, but often we're not sceptical enough of those we admire. We all suffer in that way from confirmation bias, whether Christian, atheist or something else. To question a person, ideology or doctrine isn't to be disloyal. It's about using our mind critically, even when we may not like the answers. Number two, we need accountability. No one, no matter how much of a saintly demeanour they project, should be above the structures of accountability in an organisation, as Ravi evidently ended up being. Christian ministries founded on good intentions can often collapse because the practical realities of financial, ethical and organisational accountability weren't built in from the beginning. Number three, we need to focus on truth rather than reputation. Now, this sounds obvious, but it isn't always so obvious when you're in the thick of running a large, complex, multifaceted organisation. But the fact is, the truth will out eventually, as many religious and secular institutions have discovered after trying to cover up abuse allegations rather than bring them out into the light. And truth-telling can be an incredibly painful process. So is excising a cancer, but it's necessary if the body is to survive. As Jesus memorably put it, if your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It's better for you to enter life maimed than with two hands to go into hell. Number four, we need to repent. That means more than just saying sorry once the facts can no longer be denied. It's about making genuine reparation to victims, acknowledging our own complicity in a web of deception, and making the changes that need to be made to ensure a culture that breeds that kind of deception doesn't occur again. And number five, we need to reform. It feels like there's a reckoning of sorts happening in the Christian church at the moment as a plethora of stories of fallen leaders have emerged in recent years. So why have we built so many ministries based around the charismatic personality of an individual? Why are we so good at creating pedestals for gifted but terribly flawed people to tumble from? What are the idols of success, fame and influence that we've inadvertently come to bow before? Too often, it feels like it's back to business as normal after a restoration process or a ministry name change. But if the heart isn't changed and the ethos essentially remains the same, then we're going to be doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past. So we need to learn our lessons. And I speak these words to myself as much as anyone else involved in Christian ministry, because Jesus won't be interested ultimately in how many people we reached or how successful our ministry was. He'll be interested in who we became, whether we grew more into his likeness. Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name drive out demons and in your name perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. Those are stark words from Jesus, but we need to hear them, because only by coming fully, frankly and honestly to Jesus can our own deceitful hearts be cured. I look forward to hearing your responses as well to the Ravi Zacharias scandal. And as I mentioned, we will be covering the issue in some depth on next week's show. We did have some emails that came in already on this. So I'll just read a few of these that have come out. Wesley said, wanted to thank you, Justin, for your response to the Ravi Zacharias scandal. This was published as well, what I just spoke there on our Pathos blog as well, saying we're all in need of a saviour badly. Charles said, I think that you have to address this sooner, better than later. I'm a Catholic and I wish with all my heart that the Catholic Church had ripped the Band-Aid off the problem in the 2010s. But here we are in the 2020s with the crisis still being a problem. And Glenn wanted to say, just a quick show suggestion in light of everything that's come out about Ravi Zacharias. My cursory glance through the archive didn't find anything about pastors or Christian leaders and pornography. With the high rates of usage among the general population, it's sadly to be assumed that the rates among Christian leaders are also very high. Pornography is, of course, readily available, leading many into living a double life. It must be extra difficult for Christian leaders who want to help but fear that confessing would ruin their lives, careers and families even more acutely than the average layperson. I'm not sure what resources are out there for Christian leaders in this situation, but it would be very interesting to hear informed guests talk about that issue on the show. Thank you very much for getting in touch. And this one came in. Saying, I've loved your podcast for years. Wonderful. And I could go on and on about how healing, helpful and important I think it is to find a way through a wilderness of trauma and has allowed me to regain my faith. That's so good to hear, Karen. You say, but I'm writing because I'm sure you're thinking about the Ravi Zacharias abomination. I don't think scandal is a strong enough word here. His whole ministry appears to have been constructed as a means to carry out and groom the environment for his predatory behaviour and narcissistic agenda. I don't think it's that far of a stretch to compare him to Jimmy Savile. As someone who has complex trauma, which was further added to by abuse from a minister in an evangelical youth movement, I'm one of thousands, I suspect. Certainly, I take the 50 kids I knew in my youth group, and I can start listing the extent of the abuse that most of the females were subjected to. I can only imagine how that trauma's played out in their lives and how they've tried to cope with it. I spent 20 years trying to understand it and understand the suffering that came from it, and it's actually brought me full circle to being so thankful to God for the cross, that he knows exactly what trauma is and what it does, that he really is the true shepherd who comes for his sheep, and on a personal level he really has led me to safe pastures, safe relationships, and that is the way to heal with trauma. Finally, the point of this email, it's when you're discussing this, please make sure you have read and watched as much as you can of Diane Lamberg. In fact, get her on the show. I'm concerned for others who are still in the fog and wilderness of trauma. We are reaching out to Diane at the time of recording this show, so we shall let you know if it's possible to bring her on as part of this response to Ravi Zacharias. But thank you very much for getting in touch and for sharing some of your story in that way. Let's turn to some of your other feedback in response to last week's show. This was Billy Hallowell and Michael Shermer debating demons and exorcism. Billy Hallowell has a new book out on that. He was our Christian guest. Michael Shermer, our atheist. Over on Twitter, JP said, "Too bad Shermer just fell back on Hume's dubious maxim rather than engaging with the details of the possession cases. Can't rule this stuff out a priori, but it's possible to mount strong, inductive, sceptical arguments. They just take work and engagement with the relevant empirical facts." Nikhil on Facebook says, "Jesus Christ performed exorcism, so I can't see how you can be a Christian and deny that demons exist. For the record, you don't have to be a Christian to believe in demons. They're widely accepted across many other religions as well." Others on Facebook, such as Vincent, said, "I can say for certain demons are real. Before I was a Christian, as a teenager, I was involved with a girl who was demonized. She spoke with multiple different voices and can perform supernatural acts. A group of Church of England exorcists tried to help her and witnessed the demons speaking through her. It was 1989. In time, I had demons cast out of me, spoke in voices not my own, and slithered across the floor like a snake one morning in a church service witnessed by hundreds of people, some of whom I'm still in contact with." Daniel says, "In all my long life, my only demons have been my own, created and destroyed by me. The devil is a metaphor." But Steve Cooper responds, "I grew up in the Christadelphian sect that dogmatically insisted that the devil and demons were a metaphor. I changed my mind on this the same second I met my first demon. Fortunately, I've only run into the demonic sporadically, but it is very, very real. Encounters with evil spirits are extremely unpleasant. Anyone advertising themselves as a demon hunter, I'm quite sure, has never met one." Thank you for those responses on social media. By the way, if you want to get in touch with the show today on social media, at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. You can reach out on Instagram as well, Justin.Briley there, Justin.Briley on TikTok as well, if you're a user of the TikTok forum platform. On email, the way to get in touch is unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Shane did that about last week's show to say, "Another great show, but I was disappointed that Michael Shermer didn't highlight what I thought would be one of the strongest arguments against the proven existence of demons. Namely, if demonic activity and possession were objectively real phenomena, why should they be expressed in such benign patterns as a child walking on walls, leaving residues on curtains, or inducing strange behaviour? Surely if demon possession was happening, we would see the possessed enacting, God forbid, much more sinister and damaging behaviours." Another note, both Michael Shermer and Billy Hallowell said in the episode, "If you talk to anthropologists, to make points about the beliefs of non-Christian cultures. While cross-cultural perspectives are important to consider on many topics, the field of anthropology is much, much broader than documenting non-Western beliefs. Big fan of the show, love what you do, it's really important." Thanks, Shane, out in British Columbia. JD Walters gets in touch to say, "Really enjoyed the latest episode. At first, when I saw the topic, I was disappointed that the Christian guest wasn't Richard Gallagher, given his recent book and credentials. However, I was pleasantly surprised to find Billy Hallowell has definitely done his homework. As I've expressed before, when it comes to topics like exorcisms, healings, deathbed visions, etc., we need to move past the 30,000-foot abstract worldview discussions and get into the nitty-gritty of individual cases, and Billy did just that. Unfortunately, but also ironically, Michael Shermer in the skeptic role did stay at the 30,000 feet level instead of engaging with the specific evidence Billy brought forward. He was content to trot out standard skeptical platitudes like Hume's maxim, the vagaries of mental illness and the need to believe, etc. But as skeptics are so often fond of reminding believers, platitudes aren't enough. You need to engage with the actual evidence. As a statistics teacher, I also found his frequentist approach quite lacking. He seems to think you can calculate the odds of an event like the resurrection by contrasting the one time it allegedly happened with the 100 billion other times it didn't. But that is seriously misguided. What matters is what's possible. What are the causal agents at work in the world and what they're capable of? There are plenty of weird things modern physics admits as possible that only happen under extreme circumstances, if at all. For example, proton decay, which has still never been observed. So by Shermer's approach, the odds of it happening are zero, and it's therefore impossible. But according to some very serious physics, it's very much possible. We just haven't made observations under the right conditions yet. A better sceptical guest might have been David Kyle Johnson, a philosopher who's done serious work on demons and exorcism, and is careful to actually engage the evidence instead of dismiss it for a priori reasons. That said, again, great show. Hope we'll have more discussing similar topics in the near future. Thanks, JD. And Gurgly, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. It might be Gergely. Jakus in Hungary says, I've listened and love your shows for quite a while, but I was thinking this was going to be an interesting and tough debate, as I consider miracle claims to be difficult to defend, and I know Michael is a big shot, outspoken skeptic armed with whatever necessary to obliterate the opponent. But to my surprise, Billy was very well balanced and his position was completely acceptable, while Michael was quite underwhelming, as first he talked about his new book that points out we should be careful to listen to and evaluate key arguments from the other side, and then he pulled his biggest and only objection from Hume, which has been heavily challenged, and I really don't see how it's defensible. I think if he thinks it's still a valid argument, then at least I would have expected him to defend or at least to react to its criticism. Thank you very much, Gergely in Hungary. Matthew Taylor gets in touch to say, as a 20-something adult, I had my own very dramatic demonic experience. The very short version is, following a period of expensive counselling, I attended a prayer for healing meeting at my church and went forward at the end to receive specific prayer. While being prayed for, I experienced the typical slain in the spirit response. I started hyperventilating, and then what followed was an extended session of deliverance. The whole thing was quite frightening, and I felt I had little or no control over anything for the entire time. I was fully at the mercy of those praying for me. But for me, the important event happened about a week later. I woke up in my flat before the alarm. The room was dark and I couldn't move. I was struggling to breathe. My chest felt tight, as though something was sitting on me. I tried hard to breathe but couldn't. I was scared. Being unable to move turned that fear into utter terror. Somehow, I was able to utter the words, God help me, at which point I suddenly sat upright and was able to breathe again. I've no idea how long the experience lasted, probably less than a minute. I recalled the events to those I knew in church leadership, and they all confirmed that they considered it a demonic attack. Well, imagine my confusion when 20 years later I stumbled across a description of sleep paralysis and found myself reading a very accurate explanation of that early morning event. When I examined sleep paralysis further, I discovered that the demonic attack explanation simply didn't and couldn't explain the event in anything like the detail that the natural explanation did. And that was one of several first steps that took me down the road out of Christianity. Thank you very much. I don't have time to read everything in your message there, Matthew, but that's an interesting perspective on it. Let's go for one more. This is Trent, who says, about 10 years ago, I had the opportunity to participate in a mission trip to Chennai and Bangalore, India. While visiting a slum and teaching a group of women about basic hygiene, I, along with roughly 6 or 7 other members of my church, witnessed what we attribute to be possible demonic distraction. In the midst of a pastor leading the group of women in a prayer to accept Jesus into their hearts, a series of mysterious events occurred. All of a sudden, dogs started barking. Children ran up to the building we were in and started reaching in through the windows, and a woman in the group burst into some sort of unidentifiable chanting and dancing. Our impression was that demonic activity may have tried to prevent these women from coming to know the Lord. Of course, it could be coincidence, but I've never experienced anything quite so strange. Additionally, the level of spiritual darkness present in parts of the slum was oppressive beyond words, as if energy was actively being drawn away from us. The only other place I've experienced such a weight was in the showers of Dachau. I recognise that these feelings could simply be a physiological expression of my mental states at the time. We often hear this adage about the West not understanding spiritual warfare. What's the theory behind this? Is it that the average Westerner isn't subject to the spiritual darkness that surrounds extreme poverty and oppression? Anyway, a point for consideration. Thank you very much. So many interesting responses there to that programme on demons and exorcism from last week. Again, it's available over at our website. If you'd like to find out more, then do go and check it out. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. Thank you for listening to today's show. Don't forget that we would love you, if you feel able, to sponsor a child through Compassion. Can you be one of the unbelievable sponsors? You can see the difference it made to Richmond Wandera's life, who I interviewed on the show today. If you're listening from the States, do text 83393. Text the word Justin to that number. Justin to 83393. The way to do it online is at compassion.com/Justin. And as a thank you to anyone who's able to sponsor from the US, you'll get a copy of my book, Unbelievable 2. But you can sponsor from anywhere in the world at that website, compassion.com/Justin. For now, thanks for being with me on today's show. Let me give you a heads up what's coming up next week. Well, the Christian world, and especially the world of Christian apologetics, has been rocked by the Ravi Zacharias scandal. The Independent Report published its findings a week and a half ago. We'll be bringing you a special response show on that, asking why this happened, how we can see things from the victims' perspectives, and what lessons we must learn. Guests to be confirmed, but I hope you can join me for that show, same time next week. Until then, have a good week.